Over the last 100 years, the vast majority of Catholics have experienced the Church through the medium of an urban parish. Untold millions living out their faith in the churches of Madrid, Marseille, and Manila, Lisbon, Lima, and Lagos, Sao Paulo, San Salvador, and St. Louis. But this wasn't always the case. Through most of the Church's history, a large proportion of Catholic people, like a large proportion of the world's population more generally, lived on the land and made their living from it. In this episode, Scott and I take a walk through the countryside, recounting the history of Catholic farmers and the Church's contributions to the field of agriculture.
God bless America.
God love you. I want these to be my first words of greeting to you. They will be the concluding words on each broadcast.
I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president.
Annuncio vobis, gaudium magnum, habemus papam.
You've embarked on a Catholic history trek.
Building on Jewish scripture, Christian theology had much to offer those who lived close to nature and engaged in farming. The Genesis narrative depicted a creation that was fundamentally good, even if its fallen version resisted taming, such that one who tilled the land was compelled to sustain himself by the sweat of his brow. From the beginning, mankind was charged with tending the garden. Stewardship of the land remains central to Christian creation theology to this day. The Old Testament was replete with agricultural imagery, and Jesus drew on the same for many of his parables: vineyards and sheepfolds, fertile soil and rocky ground. While Jesus and his immediate followers hailed from a mostly rural environment of shepherds and fishermen, the growth of the Church in its early decades mostly occurred in cities. The Acts of the Apostles, that first Christian history text, provides the details of Christianity's spread from Jerusalem outward to the metropolises of the Roman Empire, Antioch, Corinth, Damascus, and of course, Rome itself, which would play a rather important role in the Church's history. The leaders of the Church were headquartered in the major cities of the Mediterranean world. In addition to those already mentioned, Milan, Lyon, Alexandria, Constantinople. The Church's councils were held in cities. The grandest churches were built in cities. And the great universities emerged from the cathedrals of cities. But the gospel message gradually reached the hinterlands of the empire and beyond. By the beginning of the 4th century, around 10% of the population of the Roman Empire identified as Christian, and members of the Church could be found across the countrysides of North Africa, Spain, Asia Minor, and Persia. The legalization and sponsorship of the Church by Constantine in the early 4th century catalyzed the process of evangelizing the empire. Soon, the ministers and structures of the Church extended throughout much of the Mediterranean world. One of Catholicism's most influential institutions, monastic life, emerged as a movement to flee the cities, perceived by the early hermits and monks as hotbeds of temptation and dens of iniquity. In the 4th century, the pioneering monk St. Anthony left civilization behind to seek solitude in the deserts of Egypt. And in the 6th century, St. Benedict, the father of Western monasticism, left his studies in Rome to devote himself to prayer in rural Italy. By St. Benedict's time, the Roman Empire in the West had fallen, and a new era of church history had begun. The elite of the Germanic tribes took control of the vast Roman estates, and their Christian laborers became the serfs and peasants who populated the Catholic parishes of rural Europe during the succeeding period known as the Middle Ages.
After the fall of the Roman Empire, power became decentralized throughout Europe, and beginning around the 8th century, and predominantly in practice from the 10th through 15th centuries, the feudal system emerged, in which a lord would own a large amount of land, would grant chunks to vassals, who would then divide it into small plots for peasants to work and live. These peasants, who represented the vast majority of the population, were on the bottom rung of society and faced an extremely difficult, labor-intensive life, usually as farmers. They lived in unsanitary environments with often contaminated water supplies where disease and plague were widespread. This led to a high rate of infant mortality, with estimates that 50% of children died within the first year of life, and up to 20% of women died in childbirth. They often lived in small wood-framed single-room dwellings with dirt floors and walls made of a mixture of mud, straw, and even manure. These poorly ventilated huts were rife with bugs and disease, situation not helped by the common practice of bringing the farm animals into the home each night. On top of the hard labor and horrible living conditions, peasants were also subjected to heavy taxes. Not only did they owe their lords rent and taxes, but the church herself imposed a tithe of 10%, with the expectation the peasants would also volunteer to toil on land owned by the church. But the Catholic Church also brought relief to the peasants. Medieval life and culture were significantly shaped by the church's liturgical calendar, and the various feast days provided days of rest and festivals for these downtrodden peasants. But for the purposes of our episode, the church also brought improvements for these peasants in their tilling, sowing, harvesting, and livestock raising through the innovations of Catholic monks. Kevin mentioned St. Benedict, and in his Rule, Chapter 48 explains, "Idleness is the enemy of the soul." And so, these monks should be occupied at certain times of the day in manual labor. For example, from Pentecost until the Calends of October, they worked from prime until the fourth hour, and then again from noon until Vespers. The type of work varied depending on the monk and the monastery, but common among the monastic labors was farming. As we see in Chapter 1 of Benedict's Rule, working in the fields would affect the Wednesday and Friday fasts and the hour for dinner. The Western tradition of monasticism took its roots from this Rule of St. Benedict, and so the monastic farm work followed to monasteries of other religious communities. Not only did it provide an outlet to combat idleness, but it was practical, so these communities could eat, and it also allowed them to raise income by selling their agricultural products. Often, rough land was donated to a monastery, which the monks would then work to clear, draining swamps and converting wild forests into arable soil. The monks improved techniques for clearing the land, and made advancements in growing crops and raising livestock. There are many medieval agricultural innovations and inventions which helped improve yields, such as using water wheels and wind to power mills, inventing the horse collar for horses to pull plows, the development of the wheeled plow, the moldboard plow, and heavy plow to till the thicker clays of northern Europe, and better drainage of fields and enhanced methods of crop rotation. Because the monks were the primary drivers of science and technology in this era, and because monasteries were important centers of agriculture, it's often assumed these improved implements and practices were all invented by the monks. And they likely were, but we lack clear evidence of this. So it could be the case that a few of these advancements were not invented by the monks, but adapted by them and propagated through their various monasteries across Europe. Regardless, one field where there is more evidence of the monks' direct innovation is that of developing many breeds of farm animals through their efforts in selective breeding. While there are many types of livestock whose origins began at the monastery, I'll just focus on cattle, as there are plenty of them in the area where Kevin and I live, and throughout the rest of the Midwest. The Guernsey, known for being high in milk fat and protein, and whose milk makes for excellent ice cream, I might add, has an interesting history. In the mid-6th century, St. Sampson, the abbot of a monastery in Brittany, was offered lands on islands just off the Normandy coast of northern France. Known today as the Channel Islands in the English Channel, included the island of Guernsey, where St. Sampson arrived as a missionary. 3 centuries later, these islands came under the control of the Viking Rollo as part of Normandy. Rollo was baptized, and Guernsey saw an increased Christian presence, including monks. Within a few decades, the Benedictine monastery of Mont-Saint-Michel was established, not too far away from the famous and similarly named Mont-Saint-Michel in Normandy. It's said Robert I, Duke of Normandy, set off for England to aid his cousins against Canute. Check out our episode on St. Olaf for more on that. When a storm drove Robert to the island of Guernsey, while there, he apparently granted more land to the abbot of St. Michael's Abbey. And it was, presumably on this land, that the monks of Guernsey would develop the Guernsey cow. Not to be outdone, Several other breeds of cattle were also developed by monks on these small channel islands, the Jersey on Jersey Island, and the Alderney on Alderney Island. Additionally, there are many other cattle breeds with monasterial origins. To name a few, the Abondance came from the Abbey de Saint-Maurice d'Agoune in the 12th century, the Aubrac came from Benedictine monks at Aubrac in southern France, and the brown Swiss cow was bred by Benedictine monks in Switzerland, where they began breeding them 1,000 years ago. Even the popular Texas Longhorn was derived from cattle brought by Christopher Columbus on his second voyage to the New World. And of course, with all these advancements in agriculture, came the monastic influence on many foods and drinks created from the monks' agricultural products. As covered in episode 36, these monastic orders were responsible for bringing us many different wines, beers, and cheeses, with Munster cheese deriving its name from the word for monastery. And, of course, Kevin and I can't speak of peasants and medieval farming without mentioning the patron saint of farming, Saint Isidore. He was born in the year 1070 to a devout peasant family near Madrid, Spain. Named in honor of Saint Isidore of Seville, in his youth he was retained as a laborer by the wealthy John de Vargas of Torre Laguna, just north of Madrid. Isidore labored on the de Vargas farm for the rest of his life, raising animals and tilling the land. After being employed, he married Maria Toriba, a devout peasant like himself. After their one child died, the couple took a vow of continence to God. Continence is similar, but different than the vow of chastity or the vow of celibacy. They're often confused. Celibacy means a state of not being married. Chastity means purity according to one's state in life, while continence is the one that means to hold back or abstain. Saint Isidore considered labor as both the punishment for sin and the remedy against it, and was something to offer to God, so he worked diligently and continually prayed while he worked. He shared the little food he had with the poor, and it said when he and his wife ran out of food, more would miraculously appear, so they could keep feeding the poor. Early each morning, Isidore would set out to hear Mass, and as a result would arrive later than the other servants. Some of his fellow servants complained about this to their master, but Isidore always got his work done. Partly because he would stay and work later than his fellow servants, partly because he worked very diligently, and partly because, as the stories relate, angels would appear in the fields and plow with him. At the age of 60, Saint Isidore died on May 15th. Which is his feast day, and also the day Kevin and I are releasing this episode. After his death, his wife became a hermit and is venerated as a blessed, although in Spain, she's known as Santa Maria de la Cabeza, which means Saint Mary of the Head, because her head is kept in a reliquary. But reliquaries, relics, and the church's involvement in farming would all be affected in the coming years.
As all of our survey episodes have indicated, the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century had a major impact on the Catholic Church, and this is true also of the Church's involvement in agriculture. Most notably, it radically affected the monastic institutions that had been so prominent in food production during the Middle Ages. The Reformation gave rise, directly or indirectly, to a spate of rulers who, for reasons of politics, greed, theology, or some mixture of the three, attacked monasteries more or less ruthlessly, suppressing religious orders, expelling monks and nuns, and seizing monastic property for redistribution. In England, King Henry VIII dismantled entirely the vast network of monastic properties, including farms. In Luther's Germany, princes who took up the new faith conducted similar campaigns of confiscation. In some nations, monasteries survived the initial Reformation, but the divisions in Christianity opened the door to the emergence of anti-clericalism and state absolutism, which eventually affected almost every corner of Europe. In France, the Revolution of 1789 unleashed an offensive against religious orders. Venerable abbeys such as Citeaux and the Grand Chartreuse were forced to close for a time. In Italy, the rise of nationalism in the 19th century culminated in the unification of the peninsula and divestment of church property, including monastic farms. Meanwhile, in Spanish America, farms such as those that surrounded the missions of California were secularized by hostile governments and distributed not to native Catholics as originally intended, but to wealthy colonial landowners. In countries where the populations held to the Catholic faith, millions of peasants remained on the land. Some remained subsistence farmers, while others moved into a growing international market economy, producing meat and crops for sale. And some Catholics remained in or joined the aristocratic class, possessing large properties devoted to agricultural production. In the partially Catholic colony of Maryland, the Carroll family became one of the wealthiest in all the British colonies. Charles Carroll of Carrollton was a prominent figure in the cause of independence, the only Catholic to sign the famous Declaration of July 4, 1776. The Carrolls and other wealthy Maryland families, like many families throughout the colonies, north and south, built their wealth in part on the backs of enslaved Africans. The Carroll plantation had 300 to 400 slaves at any given time. But Charles Carroll of Carrollton also thought slavery was an evil to be gradually abolished. He tried to keep slave families intact, and he promoted Catholicism among his slaves. Many of the slaves residing on the estates of Catholic owners in places such as Maryland and Louisiana did become faithful Catholics, and in the late 19th century provided the foundation for vibrant black Catholic parishes in cities such as Baltimore and New Orleans. Venerable Augustus Tolton, the first black priest in the United States, had escaped as a boy from a farm in eastern Missouri. But I'm starting to get ahead of myself. While monasteries in many places suffered in the post-Reformation era, many also survived or were eventually restored, and they remained places of agricultural production and innovation. And I'll turn it back to Scott to provide more details on that.
Johann Mendel was born in 1822 as the second of three surviving children to an ethnically German peasant farming family in a tiny village in present-day Eastern Czech Republic. He excelled at the local elementary school and was recommended to attend a boarding school. His poor family managed to scrimp and save enough for him to attend a single year, where he distinguished himself at the top of his class. He then moved to a prep school, where he again achieved the highest grades. But when a farming accident crushed his father's chest and left him unable to help pay for the tuition, Johann became a tutor to pay his way through school. Later, his father had to sell the farm, but a small stipend was set up for Johann in the sale. When this proved insufficient, his youngest sister, Theresia, renounced her dowry to pay for his schooling. After completing his studies, Johann decided to pursue a monastic life. He joined the Augustinian Order of St. Thomas at their monastery in Brunn, a former convent dating back to 1352. By the mid-19th century, the monastery was more known for its rich resources than a religious culture, where they served fine cuisine, had a well-stocked wine cellar, had many acres of pasture lands and crop fields, and large herds of dairy cattle and sheep. This monastery had become so secular that the local bishop would later recommend its closure. As Daniel Fairbanks wrote in his 2022 work, Gregor Mendel, His Life and Legacy, the friars of the St. Thomas Monastery shunned the cloistered devotional environment of monastic hermits, preferring academic research. Mendel later explained in his autobiography, this decision to join the monastic life was primarily driven by a desire to be free of the financial struggles which plagued his family. In 1843, he was admitted with three other novices and took the name Gregor, which is how we know him today, Gregor Mendel. Due to a lack of local parish priests, the abbot accelerated his ordination to the priesthood, but his brief tenure as a parish priest was a disaster. As the abbot would later tell, Mendel was seized by an intense fear when visiting the sick and dying. So, Gregor Mendel was sent to a high school, which began a long teaching career. Always the student of science, Mendel recorded daily meteorological readings, made astronomical observations, undertook beekeeping, and tended the monastery's fruit orchard, gardens, and greenhouse, but is best known for his experiments on the hereditary traits of peas, which revolutionized the study of genetics. When the monastery's abbot died in 1867, Mendel, known for being friendly, well-liked, and having a good sense of humor, was elected as his successor. As abbot, he fully expected to continue all his different experiments and hobbies, but soon realized the time demands of managing the monastery, its vast estates, and commitments to secular societies and committees forced him to abandon just about all his scientific endeavors, which is why his research abruptly ends around this time. Over his final 10 years of life, he became embittered and distrusting, alienating many of the friars. Part of this change was due to a decades-long struggle with the government over a new tax imposed on monasteries. Many Austrian monasteries simply adjusted their books to show no profit and avoid paying the tax, but Mendel refused both to play this financial game and to pay the tax. That is until the government took it, when they sequestered the monastery's property and forcibly took the tax. Although, after Mendel's death, the next abbot reassessed the monastery finances going back to Mendel's time, showed no profits, and the government promptly repaid the taxes. Mendel was chronically overweight and, on a doctor's suggestion that smoking might curb his weight, he began smoking, and smoked as many as 20 cigars a day. In 1884, he unsurprisingly died of kidney failure and congestive heart disease. Another modern scientist monk was Karl Kerr, born in 1898 in Mittelbiberich, Germany. He entered the Benedictine monastery of Buckfast Abbey in Devon, England at the age of 11. It had been one of the abbeys affected by Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries in 1539 and had only recently been restored in 1882 by a group of French monks. He was given the religious name of Louis when he entered the novitiate, but took the name Adam during his final vows, becoming Brother Adam. He and other young novices engaged in the meticulous and arduous stonework to restore the abbey, but this proved to be too much for him, so at the age of 16, he was reassigned to help with the bees. In 1913, a disease reached the United Kingdom, possibly tracheal mites from the Isle of Wight, which devastated the native bee populations, and by 1916, the abbey had lost 30 of her 46 bee colonies. Only the colonies which had been crossbred with non-native bees survived the disease. As part of the process to rebuild the bee colonies, Brother Adam embarked on a selective breeding program to create a resilient and productive bee. He traveled extensively to study and collect bees, developed various beekeeping techniques and equipment, such as a large hive dubbed the Brother Adam Hive, and eventually created a hybrid known as the Buckfast Bee. His Buckfast Bee became highly sought after by beekeepers worldwide, and today is the most prominent hybrid bee. It's known for its gentleness, disease resistance, productivity, and adaptability. He gave lectures and published books on the many aspects of beekeeping and breeding. He was named Vice President of the International Bee Research Association, named a member of the Excellent Order of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II, and awarded 2 honorary doctorates. Brother Adam died not too long ago, in 1996, at the age of 98.
In the 19th century, in rural Poland, Germany, France, Italy, and Ireland, the descendants of the medieval peasants continued to work the land in large numbers. Bucolic images such as country churches and country curates provided material for idyllic pastoral scenes by the great artists of the period. In the 1850s, for example, the French realist Jean-François Millet produced a famous painting of a peasant couple pausing in their field to pray the Angelus, a church steeple in the distant background. "The idea for the Angelus came to me," Millet said, "because I remembered that my grandmother, hearing the church bell ringing while we were working in the fields, always made us stop work to say the Angelus prayer for the poor departed." But rural regions were changing rapidly in many countries. Many youth raised on farms in Spain, Germany, and France moved to cities where employment and other attractions beckoned. In the early 20th century, the French novelist George Bernanos saw little that was romantic in rural Catholicism. In his Diary of a Country Priest, 1936, the protagonist opens with a grim description of his surroundings. "My parish is bored stiff, no other word for it. Looking out over the village, he sees miserable little houses huddled together under the desolate, ugly November sky. What an insignificant thing a village is. And this particular village was my parish." Now, Bernanos's country priest does end up finding meaning and spiritual drama in his parish, but you'll have to check out the book to get the whole story. In any case, the picture of a backwater left behind by the modern world was a common enough image of the countryside in many Catholic nations, and lots of people sought to escape it. Many farmers and their families from Italy, Poland, Ireland, Canada, and Mexico picked up and moved to the United States, where most of them settled in cities. Millions of Irish farmers left their native counties during the terrible potato famine of the 1840s, and most of them ended up in American cities such as San Francisco, Boston, and Philadelphia. But some of these rural Europeans, especially Germans who tended to be better off financially and thus had money enough to purchase land, continued their ancestral occupation of agriculture in the new environs. Basque Catholics in Oregon and Idaho, French Canadians in New England, Irish and Germans in the Mid-Atlantic, the Midwest, and pockets of Texas, and Mexicans in the Southwest, where, in California, the Catholic labor activist Cesar Chavez would come to prominence in the 1960s as head of the United Farm Workers. So the church came to rural America as well. In western Ohio, the land of the cross-tipped churches reflects the faith of the farming families and the precious blood fathers and sisters from whom they sprang. Check out our episode on that topic way back at number 7. The Basilica of St. Fidelis, the Cathedral of the Plains, rising from the Kansas heartland along Interstate 70, points to the heritage of the ethnic German farmers who immigrated from Russia in the late 19th century. A number of bishops in the 19th century in places such as South Carolina and Minnesota promoted so-called colonization schemes, enticing urban immigrants back to the land. In Nebraska, the founding of towns such as New Posen and Warsaw testified to the settlement of hundreds of Polish farm families as part of this movement. Many prominent American Catholics started their lives on farms. The nation's first bishop, John Carroll, was raised on the Carroll family plantation in Maryland. Monsignor John Ryan, the head of the U.S. Bishop's Social Action Department and the foremost exponent of Catholic social teaching in the first half of the 20th century, came from an Irish farm family in Minnesota. St. Francis Cabrini, the dynamo of charitable action across urban America, was born to peasant farmers in Italy. Nonetheless, American Catholicism was predominantly an urban religion. In the early 20th century, the tilt was clear in the statistics. While the population of the U.S. was about 50-50, rural and urban, only 1 out of 5 Catholics lived in rural areas. The relative lack of concentration of Catholics in the country, combined with an overall shortage of priests, meant that many rural Catholics lacked access to a regular sacramental life. Some Catholic officials, noticing the particular challenges of rural living, especially social isolation and distance from the sacraments, made a concerted effort to meet these needs. In 1920, Father Edwin O'Hara, the future bishop of Great Falls, Montana, and Kansas City, Missouri, formed the National Catholic Rural Life Conference, which has ever since provided resources for rural Catholics. Its changing focus reflects the evolving environment of American culture. In the second half of the 20th century, concern for preserving the family farm in the face of trends toward consolidation into large agribusinesses, and then promotion of environmental stewardship through practices such as soil conservation and organic farming. In 1939, Father William Howard Bishop, a priest from rural Maryland, founded the Glenmary Home Missioners, a society of priests and brothers devoted to serving rural Catholics. The Glenmary Sisters were founded 2 years later. In a speech in the 1940s to Italian farmers, Pope Pius XII identified the challenges of rural living in the 20th century, but also pointed to its continuing importance. "More than anyone else," he told his audience, "you live in continual contact with nature. It is actual contact, since your lives are lived in places still remote from the excesses of an artificial civilization. Under the Son of the Heavenly Father, your lives are dedicated to bringing forth from the depths of the earth the abundant riches which His hand has hidden there for you." Today, the trends of the 20th century continue, a predominant urbanization as the children of rural Catholic families move into the city for opportunity and amenities, but also a smaller but intriguing counter-movement, as some flee the crowds for wide-open spaces, for small community churches, or for the homesteading lifestyle. Quoting the description of a recent Catholic book on the topic, "Many people today desire a simple life that is closely connected to land, whether it be gardening, farming, or ranching. There is a spiritual draw to a non-consumeristic lifestyle that places God, the family, and the home at the center of all activity. This agrarian conversion has led many families to seek out rural communities and leave behind the suburban life."
Like a scratch plow in heavy clay soil, Kevin and I have scratched the surface of the church's long history in agricultural advancement. But hopefully we've dug deep enough into our trek to plant the seeds of Catholic history for our listeners. And if you would like to trek with us through more Catholic history, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. And as always, feel free to share it with a friend. And if you feel so inclined to support our work, prayers are always welcome, as too are donations. You can find us on PayPal, Kevin Schmiesing at Catholic History Trek. If you can't spell Kevin or Schmiesing, I think you can find us by simply typing Catholic History Trek. Thank you. Gloria Patri et Filio et Spiritui Sancto, sicut erat in principio et nunc et semper et in saecula saeculorum. Amen.
Thank you for listening to Catholic History Trek. You can reach us at catholichistorytrek@gmail.com.